You were appointed, weren't you? Thank you so much. You really have the thanks of the court for the terrific job you've done for your client. Thank you. Thank you, too, government, and you, too, Mr. Storman.
Oh, welcome.
Okay. We're going to go on to the next case, which is number 04-1416, and it is Lester Byrd versus the Illinois Department of Public Health. Morning.
May it please the court. I'm Assistant Attorney General Richard Huzzack, counsel for the defendants, the Illinois Department of Public Health, and Eric Whitaker, the director of the department, sued in his official capacity. And I urge the court to reverse the judgment in this case in the plaintiff's favor on his Title VII retaliation claim, and either to direct entry of the judgment in the department's favor or to remand for a new trial under proper jury instructions that accurately state the law.
Now, speaking about proper jury instructions, your proposed instruction contained a number of errors.
I would disagree with that, Your Honor, but I will address the issue, certainly.
Yeah, starting with the first sentence, because the case that you cite in support of that sentence doesn't hold that the evidence of discriminatory motive of a non-decision maker is irrelevant. It merely states that this evidence is normally insufficient to sustain a plaintiff's burden. And inadequate to meet a burden and irrelevant are two different things. And your instruction is a misstatement of the law. The plaintiff's instruction was nearly a direct quote. And I'm wondering where you preserved your argument that the plaintiff's statement was insufficient in light of Farragher. So that's a lot.
Well, all right. Let me start at the back end, if that's okay.
Sure.
The jury instruction conference took place off the record before the jury was instructed, consistent with common practice, and then was memorialized after the instructions had been given. But it was essentially a repetition of what had occurred before the jury was charged and sent out. And the department had argued that the conduit instruction given by the trial judge, which was submitted by the plaintiffs in this case, was vague because it used this concept of conduit, which obtains meaning really only, I believe, by reading the decision from which it came in its context and in its entirety. It includes qualifications that are omitted there, but also said that there were other elements of the law relating to this sort of unusual area of imputed liability attributable to the conduct of a non-decision maker. Now, let me go to your first point, and that is, and there's been no suggestion that there was a waiver of any objection to the adequacy of the jury charge. And I think the court's precedent is clear that if there had been a waiver, not bringing it up, it's too late now, there's waiver of waiver. But I don't think there was any waiver in the first place.
Okay.
Under Rule 51. I believe, and I'd be glad to submit to the court within 48 hours or whatever period you consider appropriate, law to the effect that totally stray remarks that reflect some unlawful bias or animus by somebody who's not a decision maker are, in fact, not germane to the issue of liability of the decision maker. To the extent that you can parse this and sort of split hairs and say that there is a difference, like you describe, that renders this partially, you know, inaccurate, that pales in comparison to the errors of the instruction given. And the court's cases make it clear that if you point out errors in the instruction, it's the district court's job to get the law right, especially when this is an issue that's going to the heart of the case. The plaintiffs argued in their opening statement and their closing argument that this was one of the key pillars for their claim for recovery in this case, was this imputed bias theory. And I don't think that there's any real argument that although the court's case law may be not fully settled as to all of the nuances of this imputed liability principle, and it is a complicated one, that nonetheless this instruction given, despite express objections, omitted two things that were well settled, which is that the input has to be false or misleading because it omits relevant information or contains false information. And so this instruction invited the jury to find that true statements made by the putative, you know, skunk in the woodpile were sufficient to establish liability. And I think most important, because there was extensive evidence that the actual decision maker in this case did not merely rubber stamp some recommendation by Mr. Pitzer, who was not the plaintiff's supervisor, that the requirement that causation is broken and liability excluded when there is an independent evaluation or reliance upon sources of information not tainted by unlawful bias. We presented case law that said these are recognized elements of the law in this area, and part of it was alluded to originally in Shager, which is one of the, you know, the early decisions. But you know, those were just swept aside, and the judge said, "Nope, I'm going to go with Shager. That's it. That's enough." Leading the jury to sort of try and figure out what conduit means, and then with the emphasis by the plaintiff's counsel and their arguments, that it was enough to find that Mr. Pitzer here harbored an unlawful motive, that whatever he said, whether it was true or it was not, and regardless of whether Kate Kelly, who made the critical decisions in this case, made an independent good faith determination as to the facts she relied upon, that was all excluded. And there's no way that the court can say in this case that this error was harmless.
Now tell me, is there evidence in the record that Kelly or Langkop performed an independent investigation into Pitzer's claims?
Yes, certainly. Each of the decisions that is challenged by the plaintiff in this case is described in a long written a memorandum, whether it has to do with the minor elements of discipline that were not themselves adverse employment actions, or the later decisions 2 and 3 years after the EEOC charge that really formed the basis, you know, supposedly actionable conduct here. The evaluations are written out, and they explain what the basis of the information is. The whole grievance procedure that the plaintiff went through, Mr. Bird went through, as to every one of these things, alludes to the documents and the sources of information that were received by Kate Kelly at the time she made this. There was extensive evidence as to what the information was that went into this decision-making process, and you can see the dates of this information that correspond to when that occurred. I don't know what else to say except that, you know, the plaintiff now is arguing that because Kate Kelly wrote this all down, but a jury could have found that, you know, she was wrong, that's enough to find retaliation. And I think that's really the crux of this case. Let me get two things out of the way, and I think that narrows the focus of what the evidence issues are about. There is no evidence, and the plaintiff, appellee, doesn't even attempt to defend the proposition on appeal that Mr. Pitzer had any knowledge of his EEOC charge. There's no direct evidence. There's no circumstantial evidence. There's nothing to support that conclusion. And without that, ultimately, supposed racial animus by Pitzer, you know, the jury found against the plaintiff on his race discrimination claim, so we're down to retaliation only, and without knowledge by Pitzer of the charge in the first place, I think the case law is clear that he couldn't possibly prove a retaliatory animus by this person who's not a decision maker. And then, as I alluded to a moment ago, the only real adverse employment actions that the plaintiff can complain about are events that occurred 2 and 3 years after he filed his EEOC charge. And that is the substantial discipline that he received starting in 2001, the three major incidents. Kelly's evaluation at the end of that year said this was a bad year for Mr. Byrd and went through listing the problems with respect to that discipline. And I think it's a fair conclusion that that's why that's the first time after his EEOC charge that his evaluation went down. Before that, his evaluations had gone up to the highest possible, or not the highest theoretical level, nobody ever got that, but to the highest level given to anybody. And he's arguing that, oh no, I should have received, you know, the most extraordinary rating that, you know, nobody ever received before because I believed that I was, you know, the best regional epidemiologist, you know, on the face of the planet. That's not enough to try and to prove that he should have gotten better. So the focus of this case is whether Kelly, who was instrumental in these disciplinary decisions based upon the information she got at the time, and that's the relevant perspective, not what somebody could prove to a jury later happened based upon evidence that and information that wasn't given to her, whether she had a good faith basis, or instead did he prove that the reasons she gave were pretext, were lies to cover up retaliation.
Well, I take it that you did challenge his damages from retaliation on that ground at trial. In other words, the fact that his salary and evaluations actually went up after he filed his EEOC complaint.
That was presented to the jury. Although, given the jury's damages award, which includes not just the differences between what he would have got and what he did get after the EEOC charge if he'd gotten a higher evaluation, but included a major difference between the salary of other regional epidemiologists going years back, the base pay difference that could not possibly have related to retaliation, and in fact couldn't possibly be the result of race discrimination. The plaintiff's exhibit, I believe it's 544, they urged the jury to give him, you know, an increase in his salary to what they wanted it to be because he believed he should be getting paid more, but none of that discrepancy is justified by any plausible claim of unlawful motive here. So the crux of the plaintiff's claim here is that because he believes he didn't deserve these evaluations and he didn't deserve this discipline, and because they happened after he accused the Department of Race Discrimination, that's enough for the jury to find that the real reason was retaliatory. And all I can say is this court sees that argument day in and day out. And whether it's on summary judgment or using essentially the same standard of review, de novo, for a Rule 50 motion, the argument that we proved pretext because the decision maker was wrong, that the findings were inaccurate, isn't enough to show pretext. I could go through all the incidents in particular, the independent information that was provided to Kate Kelly with respect to these things. And I think it's worth pointing out that not only were there independent sources of this information, very often in writing to her or otherwise orally and written up in those decisions, but that there's no evidence, not only is there no evidence that Pitzer was aware of any EEOC charge, there's no evidence that Kelly had any awareness that he supposedly had any racial animus. So she had no reason to question at the outset that maybe his information was tainted for any reason. She certainly knew that the two of them were having difficulty getting along with each other, but she also knew that outside local health departments were complaining about Byrd's abrasive conduct, and that she'd received written memorandums from people at an early incident. It had gone on. This had been well documented that he had this difficulty dealing with people in the office. His own secretary had said she was throwing up in the office because she couldn't deal with the heat that she was getting from him. All of this is well documented. And to suggest that because he got up on the stand and said, no, that's not really how it happened, and presented evidence that was never submitted to Kelly at the time, that the jury could then find she was wrong and leap to the conclusion that she lied to hide retaliation, that's not enough under well-established Title VII law. Because if it were, every reasonable dispute about some employment decision that's not some trivial matter would become a Title VII claim. And where would the law be then? We're already dealing with a lot of these cases. This is a serious area, and it requires the court to look very carefully at the evidence. And I suggest that in this case, we have a lot of nothings. There's a lot of evidence, none of which amounts to any indication that any of these decisions was pretextual or retaliatory. And he's put them all together. And he said, well, we've got a lot of these things that I disagree with. That must be retaliation. Plus, it happened, you know, right after I filed my EEOC charge. Well, it didn't. None of it happened. The thing he most complained about early on was that he was told that he was going to have to submit his schedules on time. He was advised that he was falling down on the job in that regard in the evaluation that prompted him to file his first EEOC charge in the first place. That, you know, I don't think that there's enough prescience in the department to try and engage in that type of retaliation. What really happened was years later. He tries to compare himself with other employees.
Do you want to save some rebuttal time?
I did save 3 minutes,
no.
Did I not?
You're way into it.
Yes, I would. Okay. Thank you. I'm sorry. I didn't realize that the lights were not set for my rebuttal time.
Thank you.
Well, they were set.
The white light means 3 minutes.
My apologies.
The yellow light means... 1 minute.
Okay, I thought red was going to mean that I was down to just my 3 minutes.
I'm
going to
give you a minute anyway.
I appreciate it, Your Honor, and I apologize for the misunderstanding.
Never question our lights. They always work.
Good morning. May it please the Court. My name is Susan Andorfer, and I represent the plaintiff, Lester Byrd, in this case.
Ms. Andorfer, I'm going to start you right off on the instruction.
Okay.
Because whereas it's my view, certainly, that the state's proposed instruction contained a number of errors, your instruction, the one that was actually given, seems to allow the jury to hold the state liable even if the decision makers had no idea that they were relying on a person motivated by prejudice or retaliation. And what you need to try and explain is how that instruction could ever square with Farragher. And also, if there was any other instruction that addressed the need to show that the employer knew or should have known about the illegal bias of the person who provided the information about the plaintiff?
Well, first of all, in Shager, the decision maker, which was the career path committee, did not know that the supervisor who had given input to them had made bias comments, age bias comments. And so I don't think knowledge on the part of the decision maker as to whether the person who was giving input had bias is necessary under that case.
Well, I mean, the instruction given, of course, was nearly a direct quote from Shager, but there was no accounting for the significant changes that have been brought about by Farragut and even by some case law in our circuit prior to Farragher. So you better talk about Farragher. Let's not.
Okay, I can do that. Farragher held that an employer is vicariously liable to an employee for hostile work environment case created by a supervisor with immediate or higher authority over the employee. And Farragher allows an employer to, if there's a tangible employment action against the employee, then the employer is allowed to raise two affirmative defenses. One, that the employer exercised reasonable care to prevent the harassing behavior, and two, then that the employee unreasonably failed to take advantage of those preventive measures. In this case, there was, and then Farragher also says, however, that those affirmative defenses are not available if there was a tangible employment action. And I would submit, in this case, there was a tangible employment action because Mr. Byrd was received not only lower pay raises every year after he filed his charge of discrimination, but he was also suspended at some point, so there was a tangible employment action. So
what's the evidence that Kelly or Lankop knew that Pitzer was motivated by racism when he made all of these complaints about Byrd?
I don't believe there was evidence that they directly knew that he was motivated by race. Mr. Byrd had complained to somebody in the Human Resources Department at the Human Resources Division of the department that Mr. Pitzer was biased. And I think there's an inference could have been drawn by the jury that Kate Kelly, as the supervisor, and Langkop as the supervisor above her, were aware of those complaints because Mr. Byrd had made a formal complaint about Mr. Pitzer in the past. So I think it was reasonable for the jury to infer that knowledge certainly got back to Mr. Byrd's supervisors. But I was also submit that that on the retaliation claim, there was evidence that Kelly and Langkop themselves had a retaliatory motive against Mr. Byrd. So the jury didn't have to rely on the fact that Pitzer was the only one with a retaliatory motive.
Tell us what that is.
What Kelly and Langkop's retaliatory motive was? Mr. Byrd filed his charge of discrimination in April of 1999. In the summer of 1999, Kelly and Langkop were both aware that he had filed that charge of discrimination because the evidence was that they actually participated in the fact-finding conference that was held by the Illinois Department of Human Rights about his race discrimination charge. And it was only after that that Byrd was subjected to 5 disciplinary actions. His work with the Bi-State Conference was curtailed. The department attempted to kill the Lester Byrd Award, and then he got a whole series of negative performance evaluations and lower pay raises. So our contention is that the jury did not have to rely on this bias from Mr. Pitzer. Now, they did have to with the race discrimination claim. So I think there's a difference between the evidence for the retaliation claim and the evidence for the discrimination claim. And as you know, the jury found against Mr. Byrd on the race discrimination claim.
See, that's sort of interesting. I'm sure you're going to say that the retaliation claim was the stronger of the two that went to the jury. I'd expect you to say that because that's the one the jury came down on. But it seems to me that the emphasis of this case was on the race discrimination much more than retaliation. Maybe I'm wrong, but
well, I think if you read the opening and closing statements, that's correct. And I think that we hit on those stronger because we felt like they needed to be hit on stronger. But I think that the retaliation case was the stronger of the two because there was evidence that Kelly and Langkop had a retaliatory motive against Mr. Byrd. And we didn't have any evidence that Kelly or Langkop had made racially derogatory statements against Mr. Byrd. Those came from Pitzer.
Does the disputed instruction here have anything to do with the retaliation claim?
Yeah, I think it does in the sense that the jury could have inferred that Mr. Pitzer had a retaliatory motive as well. So in that sense, I think the retaliation or that the instruction could apply to the retaliation claim.
Your opponent says there's no evidence that Mr. Pitzer knew about the EEO complaint.
Well, actually, I think there was enough for the jury to infer that he did know. He never testified one way or the other as to whether he knew. So he was never asked, when did you know or did you know? He was also never asked, you didn't know, did you? And but there was enough to infer, since he was involved in 4 of the 5 disciplinary actions, since there was a grievance about all of those, since he had 80 emails between he and Kate Kelly over a span of 2 years, I think the jury could have inferred that at some point he knew that Mr. Byrd had filed this race discrimination charge. So I think there could have been an inference.
So that he had a retaliatory motive that could be imputed to Kelly.
Correct.
Even if she didn't.
Correct.
So we do have to address that legal issue about whether that instruction was in error or incomplete in some way.
Well, I think so. There wasn't a distinction made to the jury that this instruction applies to one claim and it doesn't apply to the other. So I think, yes, she would have to address it.
You know, I asked you so many questions earlier that, of course, one might not have been responded to, but I would really like to know if there was any other instruction that addressed the need to show that the employer knew or should have known
whether there was any
of the illegal bias.
Whether there was any other
Kitzer.
Was there any other instruction submitted by any of the parties?
Yeah. Well, that was given.
I don't believe so. The not that I'm aware of. It was just the one instruction that addressed it. The jury was told, was given the business judgment instruction to the jury, telling the jury that the employer did have substantial latitude in the exercise of its business judgment. So they were given that instruction. That was submitted by the defendant. And the instructions regarding the plaintiff had to meet his burden of proof and the elements of the retaliation claim were also submitted, and those were not objected to. It was only this one particular instruction. But I think the cases, including Shager and some of the even the Wallace and the Willis cases, don't say or hold that the decision maker has to know that the discriminating employee actually had this particular bias. The connection is whether they were influenced by it. And I want
to standard in the circuit, let me be pretty clear about that.
Okay.
Requires that the employer knew or should have known that adverse action was based on discriminatory animus.
Our position is that for imputed knowledge, is that not what you're asking me?
No, go ahead.
Okay, I was going to say that the standard in the circuit and under the cases is that if there's imputed knowledge from a discriminator to a decision maker, that there is, the decision maker does not have to know that the discriminator had that bias when the decision was made. That is not the requirement. Let me address the prejudice issue with regard to the instruction. Because the department not only has to show that the instruction was inaccurate, but also that they suffered some sort of prejudice. And even with the challenged instruction, the jury was able to sort out the evidence and find in the department's favor and against Mr. Byrd on his discrimination claim.
But since you've already conceded the instruction is also important to the retaliation claim, why would that matter?
Well, because the department has to show that, assuming for sake of argument, the instruction was accurate or inaccurate. The department also has to show that it was prejudiced. Well, it certainly wasn't prejudiced by the instruction with regard to the discrimination claim, because they won on
it. Certainly prejudiced them on the retaliation claim if they're paying all these damages.
But they can't have it both ways. They can't say they can't have an instruction, the same instruction, and win with it, and say that the jury was confused. If the jury was confused, then they wouldn't have found in the department's favor on the discrimination claim. Actually, the instruction was more important on the discrimination claim.
Juries split the difference
all the time. you better.
Okay. Well, the other reason they weren't prejudiced by the instruction was because Kelly and Langkop had their own retaliatory motive. So the jury could have decided that Kelly and Langkop suspended Byrd and gave him lower pay raises all on their own and separate and apart from anything that Pitzer might have infected them with concerning Mr. Byrd, because they were retaliating against him for filing this charge.
Was that really argued to the jury? Or was this pretty much all on Pitzer?
I can't exactly remember all of my argument. I think a lot of it was on Pitzer. But we certainly made the point, and there certainly was evidence, that Kelly and Langkop participated in this fact-finding conference in the summer of 1999, right after they filed the charge of discrimination. So it wasn't like we didn't touch on it at all. Mr. Byrd talked about how Kelly at that fact-finding conference said, oh, well, I think you need to stop your activities or curtail your activities with the bi-state conference. So we started her actions against him at that point.
Before you sit down, let me ask you, if we were to reverse and order a new trial on the retaliation claim, would the damages have to be retried?
No.
Okay. I'm going to see what they think.
Because the damages were all... our contention is that the retaliation led to, started off, and he started getting lower pay raises and got lower pay raises for every year after that. And that's what contributed to his damages. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Will you give Mr. Husad 2 minutes, please? Because there was confusion.
I apologize. Thank you kindly, Your Honor.
Let that be a lesson to all of you.
And the sign is clear. The easiest factual issue is that there's no evidence that Pitzer knew about the EEOC charge. The issue then gets down to Kelly's alleged retaliatory motive, and there's no proof of pretext, suspicious timing, telling contrast with supposedly similarly situated employees. Under that basic framing of the case, plaintiffs lose. There isn't enough to go to the jury. The most interesting legal issue is what should be the standard for liability for an employer under this imputed liability principle involving a non-decision-making employee. And I noticed that the court's draft jury instructions don't touch this issue. And it is a difficult one. Trying to be humble, the court's decisions have sometimes overlapped the separate issues of causation and employer liability. And Farragher makes it clear that they are different and distinct. And for employer liability, when you don't have a supervisor, as that term is defined, taking the tangible action for an unlawful reason, then you have to look at other factors. That's an issue that the Supreme Court may have to decide. But I would at least say that in these circumstances, that the instructions given were clearly a misstatement of what was well established in this circuit, and there's no justification for that. There was, in fact, no evidence that Langkop or Kelly were aware of any racial animus by Pitzer. The EEOC charges mention Pitzer only in the summer of 2000 and then say nothing about racial animus or racially animated comments by him at all. There's nothing to show that was anywhere in the record. Everybody treated this instruction as applying to both claims. I think the concession by Eppley's on that point is justified. But there's no basis to infer Pitzer had a retaliatory animus. The supposed 80 emails that went back and forth, they didn't put them into evidence. There's no showing that they included anything disparaging or negative. The department was prejudiced. We are not trying to have it both ways. There must be a retrial on damages if there's a retrial on liability. I urge the court to reverse and either direct judgment or remand for a new trial. Thank you so kindly, Your Honor.
Thank you all. Thank you, Mr. Husen. Thank you, Ms. Andorfer. The case will be taken under advisement.